Hello, welcome to our program on careers. I'm Irene Lubin, a volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. Today I'd like to begin with an article which appeared in the Wall Street Journal on the 22nd of September. This article was written for the journal by Callum Borchers. How to handle a job market that's worse than it looks. It's time now to change your attitude and approach as gloomier employment picture comes into focus. The official story of the job market is finally catching up to the harsh reality. Job seekers have complained for some time now to me, to their friends, to their pets, or anyone who would listen, that it is deceptively hard to get hired these days. Normal people do not wear out the refresh button on BLS.gov when the federal government is about to drop new employment data like I do. But they know in broad strokes that the numbers continued to look good long after the post-pandemic hiring frenzy subsided. Many felt a disconnect between those rosy stats and their own experiences. Wednesday's interest rate cut by the Federal Reserve and the recent downward revision to the government's estimate of U.S. job growth confirm what a lot of people sensed. The labor market is weaker than it appeared. The Bureau of Labor Statistics now is saying that the country added less than half as many jobs as originally reported during a recent 12-month period. It's vindicating, says Heather Reynolds of Dallas, who has been looking for work since being laid off by a financial services company in March. There's nothing worse than walking into my parents' house and having my dad say, "What are you doing with this job search?" Like a lot of people, Reynolds, who is 53, has dealt with the implication that she must be doing something wrong. She hopes that will change as the true challenges of landing a job become clearer. It's time to have evidence to support your frustration, but being right won't get you a job. That's why acting on recent news, not just saying "told you so," could be the key to improving your prospects. Step one might be working the gloomier hiring picture into your job hunting narrative. Reynolds is an experienced recruiter who knows unemployment can be a self-perpetuating cycle. Prospective employers sometimes see applicants who have been out of work for a while as tainted, assuming that they would have been hired sooner if they were good candidates. Now, at least, you can note that you're caught in a widespread hiring slowdown if you get the dreaded resume gap question in a job interview. Just try not to come off whiny. Go for a subtle reminder that long-term unemployment is not necessarily due to individual shortcomings. Remind yourself of this, too. Understanding the landscape can help protect your confidence amid a trying job search. Digital marketer Ostra Zubkovs has been looking for her next full-time job for about a year and a half while working as an independent consultant. She is open to relocating from Albany and takes some comfort in knowing that she is far from alone. "I don't even feel embarrassed anymore," says Zubkov, 39. "Part of me feels like I should, but so many people are in the same spot." Kirsten Hermansen is one of them. She went more than two decades without having to hunt for a job as she climbed the ranks on Paramount Communications team. Then she was part of a large layoff last year and has been looking ever since. In hindsight, she underinvested in networking when times were good for her. "I thought LinkedIn was just something for people who are unemployed," says Hermansen, who is in her late 40s now and lives in the Los Angeles area. "Now I'm in it." She's making up for lost time by sending 50 connection requests a week, and she doesn't reach out only to people she thinks could help her find a job. Hermansen contacts just about anybody who seems interesting to her, often asking to meet on Zoom. Some blow her off, but not all. She says she's had fascinating discussions with people in other states and countries, including Australia, India, and Egypt. If nothing else, this exercise sharpens her conversation skills for job interviews. Plus, you never know when a connection will pay dividends off, and it's always better to form a relationship before you need to ask for a favor. You likely have heard sermons about the importance of networking, but this is a moment to pay attention. Our efforts tend to sag when we feel comfortable in our roles, or when the job market looks strong enough because we assume we'll be fine out there. It should be apparent at this point, though, that our positions and the employment situation overall are not so stable. Kyra Franson learned the hard way that there are no guarantees out there. She quit her job as an administrative assistant 2 years ago, confident that she would easily land another job. Her plan was to complete a medical office professional certificate program, living on savings and her partner's income in the meantime. 5 months after graduating, though, she remains unemployed. She feels she had a false impression of the job market's health when she walked away from her last position. I'm going to look at the numbers with skepticism and not take them as reality going forward, says Franson, who is 50 and who is looking for jobs in Colorado or in North Carolina. It's tempting to dismiss job market reports as unreliable, but a better approach is to look at them differently. I would discourage anybody from throwing them out, says Dannon Yarnell, Associate Provost and Executive Director of Career Development at the University of Richmond. He advises students and job seekers alike to focus on trends instead of fixating on raw numbers alone that are prone to revisions. That means paying attention to which industries and regions show steady signs of growth, rather than basing your view of the job market on the monthly totals that make headlines. Sounds like good advice, but brace yourself as you do your research. Massachusetts and the District of Columbia, where I have spent much of my career, rank 47th and 51st in year-over-year employment gains by percentage. Excuse me while I send a few LinkedIn connection requests to people in South Carolina and New Mexico, which rank first and second. The next article that I would like to read for you is also written by Callum Borchers for the Wall Street Journal. This article appeared in the journal last May. Well-paid job hoppers bemoan cooler market. Some fear if they had to find a new job today, they couldn't match their pay. All of us like to think we are worth every penny of our paychecks, and then some. Many Americans who scored big raises a few years ago are coming to the harsh realization, though, that they are overpaid in today's cooler job market. It's not that they are failing to live up to the deals they signed up for. It's that wages have fallen in tech and other industries, while the expansion of pay transparency laws makes it hard to ignore the truth. Go ahead and snicker at these lucky stiffs, but consider that you might be one of them. Two-thirds of U.S. workers say they are compensated at or above the current value of their skills, according to a new workforce report by consulting firm Korn Ferry. We're certainly seeing a shift in the last year with our clients, says Ron Seifert, a senior client partner at Korn Ferry. They're not as aggressive in recruiting. They monitor offers a lot more carefully. I spoke recently with more than two dozen people who job hopped during the pandemic era talent war. For a lot of them, a sense of dread taints the satisfaction of having gotten raises while the getting was good. They fear they wouldn't be able to match their pay packages if they were looking for work today. The thought of a pay cut is especially unnerving for those who bought homes and built comfortable lifestyles around their higher earnings. Some are worrying that their salaries could put both eyes on their backs if their employers decide to cut costs. A virtual reality specialist who tripled his total compensation upon joining Meta a few years ago says that he suspects his salary is one reason why he was laid off. A sales manager who had a generous incentive plan says her boss implied that she had become overpaid before laying her off. I've been on the inside with companies as they make layoff decisions 1,000 times, says Andy Challenger, who is senior vice president of Challenger, Gray & Christmas, which advises businesses on job cuts. Inflated compensation packages relative on to the job market can, of course, be a part of these decisions. Jacob Tim, who is a software engineer in Minnesota, used to think a better offer was always around the corner. Recruiters contacted him on LinkedIn almost daily back in 2021 and 2022. In one six-month burst, he received an internal promotion and then was poached by another company, moves that collectively boosted his earnings by 70%. Now the headhunters reach out to him every month or two. He's not out there looking for a new job, but often browses open roles to gauge how his pay stacks up against advertised salaries. It's on the high side, especially for fully remote positions such as his. If I got laid off, I think it would be hard for me to match my current salary, says Tim, who is 30 years of age. I think I'd have to look a little bit longer and be willing to take a pay cut if I went 6 months without a job. Seeing how the labor market has shifted now, he and his wife padded their emergency fund. They now keep 9 months of expenses in reserve instead of 3 to 6 months. Several others whose pay spiked told me that they are confident that they could equal their salaries on the open market today. They don't worry about being replaced by cheaper talent. Figuring the cost of recruiting and training would somehow negate their employer savings. Still, more job switchers are settling now for lateral moves or for pay cuts than they were a few months ago. Just 6 out of 10 people who recently changed jobs received pay increases, according to ZipRecruiter's latest quarterly survey of new hires. That is down from 73% in the fourth quarter of last year. In early 2022, nearly half of job switchers pocketed raises of at least 11%. Paige Sheldon, who is an accountant in Colorado, changed jobs in a year around that time and increased his salary by 47%. Definitely wouldn't be able to replicate that right now, that's for sure, he says. Sheldon, who is 30, benefited from a surge in demand for CPAs at the time as the economy revved back up and corporate deal-making moved. Now, tariffs and general economic uncertainty are cooling merger activity. He says he now would expect stagnant pay and less work from home flexibility if he were to switch jobs. Joseph Magnuson, who works in private equity in Texas, scored a roughly 60% raise when he jumped to a different firm in 2021. He says he's glad he didn't follow some of his peers who chased even bigger gains. That's only partly because he is married with 3 children and values work-life balance. It's all kind of coming to a head now, and the people who were really opportunistic are starting to lose their jobs, says Magnuson, who is 32. Transaction volumes are down, projected returns are falling, and fair market wages are declining a little bit. People's level of panic depends on how they viewed massive raises in the first place. Some say they knew all along that their offers were inflated by once-in-a-lifetime or a generation hiring frenzy. Figuring a correction was coming, they've been conservative with their personal finances. And others confess to thinking that their paychecks were on a rocket ship bound for even greater heights. If that's you, it could be wise to prepare for a time when the projectile falls back to earth. The next article that I would like to read for you is from the Wall Street Journal, the 16th of June. The trick to saying no at work. This article was written for the Wall Street Journal by Vanessa Patrick. Most people are conditioned to say yes to their bosses and their colleagues. It's harder, but it is important to be able to turn things down. Many of us feel compelled to say yes to things that make us miserable. Yes to work that is not our job. Yes to taking on jobs when we're at home or even on vacation. Yes to boring, unnecessary meetings or to company dinners. We don't want to, but we feel like we have to. As human beings, we are hardwired to help, and we are conditioned to be cooperative. We believe that saying yes means that we are a team player, a good friend, a successful professional. Refusing seems like it isn't an option and will bring terrible consequences. But saying yes to things we don't really want to do also has terrible consequences. It can make us unhappy and also resentful. A successful businesswoman and consultant shared with me once that she tended to be nice, which gave her a reputation as a pushover. Her colleagues would often point people in her direction, saying, "Ask her, she will definitely say yes." She was often stressed and overwhelmed with helping others. But as my research with hundreds of people shows, we can learn to say no, and we can do it with confidence and with conviction. To do it, we need to learn the proper way to evaluate what people are asking for us and the most effective ways to respond. Most of all, we need to set up principles for ourselves. I call these personal policies that clearly define what we will accept and what we won't, and then stick to them. Why is a simple no so hard for us to say? My research reveals that this feeling of obligation stems from a few underlying, albeit often false, beliefs about saying no. We think no can damage the good relationship with the asker, and that the asker won't be willing to do something we ask for down the road. We fear that no will convey ineptitude and unprofessionalism. It will stain our reputation. But in fact, the opposite is true. People perceive you as more decisive and purpose-driven when you do say no to the right way. And people would much rather have you say no up front than to say yes and then drop the ball later on. If you do a shoddy job or don't deliver on time because you are overwhelmed or overcommitted, you damage your relationships and your reputation much more than if you had said no in the first place. As one person told me during a coaching session, you are not doing your reputation any favors by biting off more than you can chew. Saying no to a client's request or even hiring an external consultant helps to secure your reputation and ensure client satisfaction. Saying no also makes us feel better. When we say no to something we didn't want to do in the first place, we feel relieved and happy instead of angry, frustrated, and resentful. One simple question. Saying no to the right way starts with one simple question. Is this request worth it or not? Obviously, not all requests are created equal. Some requests, like passing the salt at a dinner table, are low cost to us but highly beneficial to the other person. Those often deserve a yes. Let's say you are a whiz at Excel and you have the opportunity to help a coworker who doesn't know the program at all. You could do a task in a few minutes that might take the other person days to figure out. Saying yes would be a pass the salt request for you. Other requests may be highly costly to us with minimal benefit to others. A friend might ask you to bake a complex dish for a potluck dinner because the meal is your specialty. Can you make your lasagna? These requests require careful scrutiny and often warrant a firm no. The purpose of a potluck, for example, is to share a lot of different dishes, not necessarily have the tastiest homemade food. If you want to make a top-notch signature dish for people to enjoy, it should be on your terms, perhaps at a dinner party you host. Once you have decided to refuse a request, you must communicate your refusal effectively. My research shows that people often make a mess of it. Some use avoidance and assume that the asker will get the refusal from their silence or disappearance. Yes, ghosting an innocent asker is not uncommon. Askers interpret this as unresponsive, which it is. On the other hand of the spectrum is the awkward, wishy-washy refusal. No, but if you really want me to, I'll do it. Or aiming to offer a compromise, but this type of answer only leaves both of you and the asker guessing about where things really stand. You come across as indecisive, unclear about your priorities, and a poor communicator. Look inside. Those strategies are effective as a starting point, but there is a larger strategy for saying no that will help you judge requests much more quickly and reply much more effectively. First, do some self-examination. Figure out your principles and set rules for sticking to them. You might set up a rule to maintain the quality of work you do. I don't take on new projects till I am well underway with my progress on the ones already on my plate. Or establish a personal policy that helps you maintain better work-life harmony. I don't take calls or meetings after 6 p.m. or on the weekends because that is family time. Use those principles to guide your choices, eliminating the need for case-by-case deliberation. These predetermined rules will strengthen your resolve and make refusal feel natural. Instead of just saying no, you make it clear that the answer comes from the core of your values, your beliefs, your priorities, and your preferences, instead of your mood or schedule at the moment. When you ground your refusal in who you are, you come across as more determined and are less likely to get pushback. Then choose your words. Then, when you do refuse, frame your response with empowered language. For example, use "I don't," "not," "I can't," which signals that your no stems from who you are and the rules you have set for yourself. Communicate that the refusal comes from our core principles rather than mere convenience. "I can't" suggests helplessness and temporary obstacles. When you say, "I'm sorry, I can't," it often raises the question, "Why not?" and invites negotiation. Also, don't give excuses when you say no. That invites questions. Instead, be firm and resolute. If you say, for instance, that you are too busy now, you leave the door open for the other person to ask you again. Consider a senior executive who would like to reserve the quiet morning hours for strategic planning, but keeps getting pulled into early meetings. Making excuses about why he or she cannot attend could send the wrong message. Instead, he or she could say, "I don't do early morning meetings," which conveys determination and commitment and frees up the time to do the most important work. And don't just state your refusal, bring your whole self into the response. A warm smile, friendly gestures, and confident body language reinforce that your no is about your priorities rather than a rejection of the asker. If you do find yourself stuck for an answer in the moment, don't respond too quickly. Always buy time to evaluate the request. Be prepared with handy phrases. "I will have to get back to you. Let me look at my calendar." Like anything worth doing, learning to say no effectively requires patience, practice, and persistence. Say yes to that challenge. The following is from a question-answer column written by Anna Holmes for the Wall Street Journal. This is from the Wall Street Journal, the 10th of August. The question: meetings run amok. I started my job in late 2024 as an assistant, primarily to support with scheduling, meeting notes, and administrative tasks. My boss saw potential in me and began assigning higher level projects for me. This is work I enjoy and want more of, but it's come without adjustments to my original workload. We're a three-person team, and since I joined, my boss has taken on major new initiatives, and then delegated most of the execution to me. Now I'm managing complex projects and handling every calendar request, expense, shared inboxes, and offsite events. We sometimes have multiple per week. I've raised concerns about bandwidth, and while my boss expresses empathy, she immediately follows up with more tasks for me. Speaking of meetings, usually two full days a week are consumed by them. Any advice about a boss whose solution to bandwidth problems is calling more unproductive meetings? From Anonymous. The response here. There are at least two things going on here that I see. First, you're being asked to do too much work. And second, your workplace has a toxic meeting culture. My advice here. Have a conversation, yes, another, with your boss about your bandwidth issues. Is there someone else that some of your tasks can be delegated to? I suggest you first put it in writing, outlining your concerns about the specific task that you're expected to take on that make it harder for you to do the more challenging and rewarding parts of your work. Then ask if you can and have an in-person conversation about it. You might want also to approach the situation by reiterating your interest in and excitement for your job and the additional opportunities you have been given. Then you can express your concern that continuing to handle older tasks is getting in the way of you moving forward in your career with the company. Communicate that you want to grow professionally and to move past the sort of work that you initially started out to do. Then suggest some ways the two of you can work together to make that happen. As for the unproductive meetings, unfortunately, this is not really an issue you can bring up with your boss, at least not easily, and probably without making her defensive. My advice is to ask her if you might occasionally skip a meeting because of tasks that need tending before the end of the workday. This may subtly communicate that not all meetings are created equal, meaning that you'd appreciate the opportunity to miss a few in order to make sure that the work you're doing is done well and that you have boundaries for when your workday needs to end. Good luck with this. This does bring us to the end of the time that we have for our program on careers for today. I hope that you've enjoyed listening in and will enjoy the rest of your day. And thank you for listening. I'm Irene Lubin, a volunteer reader, and you're listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona.